Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And this week is this month's State of Play episode, where I am joined by Bill D'Alessandro, the most, I was going to say probably, but I think it's by far and away definitive at this point, the most popular and regular co-host of the show. He co-hosts the Acquisitions Anonymous podcast, which you should be listening to if you're not, even if you're not interested in buying and selling a business. They talk about so many things you can learn and apply to your business through what businesses are attractive, what problems arise for businesses trying to sell themselves that you can use to strengthen your own business. He also is the owner and the CEO of the Natural Dog Company and just a general all-around fantastic guy. Bill, welcome back. I love doing these episodes with you, man.
Oh, me too. I'm glad to be here. Do we have a real brand? Am I the State of Play guy now? Is that what our episodes are called, our regular episodes?
That is the working title. I had about 10 minutes to come up with something and I couldn't come up with anything more original. So this is the State of Play episode for March.
Okay, I'll work on it. So I am, our other podcast that you mentioned, Acquisitions Anonymous, when we put it together, it was originally called Deal Talk. And I said, guys, I cannot abide this. Like, as the branding guy of the three of us, like, this needs a better name. And I workshopped it and we came up with Acquisitions Anonymous. So I will kick it around. We'll see if we do better than State of Play.
That's I appreciate it. This is Bill's very tactful Southern charm way of saying, I can't believe this is the name that I'm being a show on, and we're gonna have to overhaul this, which is probably fair.
You've got some runway. You came up with E-commerce Fuel, which I think is a great brand and has been very durable. So I'll give you a pass.
I can't even steal that one. I have to give Annie the credit for that one. Anytime I need anything word related, words are not my forte. And so I'm more of a numbers guy.
That's why you started a podcast.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, lean into your strengths, baby. Right. So, well, Bill, quickly before we dive in, we got a bunch of stuff to talk about. And if you haven't listened to these before, which is likely because we've only had, I think, one of them, we are going to be recapping the past month, especially with things that have happened in the private community, the E-commerce Fuel community for established store owners. So talking about some of the things happening there, the top discussions, questions, interesting questions that come out of those, et cetera. But before we do, Bill, what is going on in your world over in Charlotte?
Well, it's spring. It's starting. It's getting warm. I'm sure in Montana it still has snow on the ground, but spring is starting here, which is great for me because I like to be outside, but it's also great for our business because we actually have a lot of allergy products. So as soon as the pollen comes out, the dogs start itching and scratching, and our sales start to ramp. So we have a little bit of positive seasonality, kind of spring and summer. So we're starting to see that kick in over the last week or so.
What's better, having sales start to go on the incline or having the winter temperatures disappear? I feel like for me, I would have to have a pretty, that would be hard. Which one of those is more buoyant to your spirits?
It depends. My favorite part is being outside while watching the sales go up on the back porch.
Just sitting there with a cocktail in hand in the warm weather for the first time in months and hearing that ding on the Shopify app go crazy.
That's right. That makes the business sound very 4-hour work week, which I've talked at length on this show about how, is more or less a myth, the true 4-hour work week. But yes, it is nice.
Yeah. Funny, speaking of spring weather, we just drove down this last week from Montana where we left Montana, and it was like, I'm not joking, there was like four, it was starting to get a little slushy, but there was 4 feet of snow in our front yard. It was so much snow to the point where when our kids would go outside and make snow forts, we had them buddy up like they were backcountry skiing, because if they, one of those snow forts collapsed on them, they would literally die. So they could not go out and play unless they had a brother or sister who could come back and say, Theo is suffocating, come out and save him. And then we drove south to Tucson, where we are now. And yeah, it's just like 80 degrees. It's crazy. It's crazy how much 15 hours, 18 hours of driving and 3,000 feet of elevation can change your world. It's kind of mind-blowing.
So. Or 3 hours in an airplane. I mean, that's...
Or 3 hours, yes. It's just mind-boggling. Enough about snow, weather, all this kind of stuff. Hope it's a little bit warmer where you are and you're starting to get some sun and some warmth. I want to kick things off by talking about my favorite thread of the month in the ECF forums. And this is a topic that Zach is going to be coming on the podcast either next week or in the very near future to talk about. Zach built his own inventory planning and forecasting tool. They have a fairly complex They have, I think, 1,000 plus SKUs. They have a pretty complex supply chain. I think they warehouse, they drop ship. They've got, there's a lot of moving parts. And they were using a popular SaaS inventory planning tool. It wasn't quite, it was expensive, or it cost them, it was a meaningful investment. And it didn't quite do everything that they wanted it to. And so Zach, who's a technical guy, but not a programmer, sat down, spent a bunch of time learning the ropes for all of the new AI tools that are coming out to help with programming. I think there's like Replit, there's Cursor, you can use ChatGPT, and we'll get into all the details on exactly how he did that in the coming week episode. But within about 150 hours of work, he put together a full-fledged replacement for their inventory software planning tool that not only had additional custom functionality for their business needs, but it also is going to save them over six figures in SaaS fees. And I saw this. This has been something that's been on my wanting to do list for a year now. I haven't had the bandwidth to carve out to make it happen. But it just was such an amazing case study to me, not in terms of even just cost savings, which is impressive, but the custom functionality, because so for so long, Bill, you're the same way. You've got a programming background. I have a little bit of a programming background, but I'm by no means a good programmer. I can just kind of hack at it. There's always stuff you want to do, but the hard part is the expense and the time to make it happen. And I feel like those roadblocks are just falling away precipitously. And it's a pretty cool time. So anyway, Bill, I'd love to get your thoughts. Have you experimented with this much in your business? Like, have you done any AI programming, played around with these tools at all?
Well, so I played with it probably 6 months ago, which might as well have been 10 years ago, the speed that this is all evolving. And 6 months ago, it was able to get pretty close. I was trying to build a little web app, kind of like web utility app, and it got like kind of there. But, you still definitely had to be technical to get all your credentials in and your environment variables right and kind of bug fix it. But as I understand it, I need to go back to it because it is to the point now where you can build basic stuff, without much programming knowledge.
Well, I think you can build even more than basic stuff without much programming knowledge. And it's not just, the thing that's cool is it's not just, hey, ChatGPT or Claude or whatever it is can analyze code and give you suggestions on it. That is true. But there are entire ecosystems, Replit, I might be mispronouncing that, Replit, R-E-P-L-I-T. And again, there's many of them. Cursor is another one. There's others where it's an entire IDE, which is like a programming environment, where you can chat with it. And not only will it let you create the code and let you kind of use a chat interface to create and edit code and make it better, but it also handles setting up the programming environment for you. So if you're going to be programming in a Python, it will set that up, or PHP, it'll create the server, the Apache server, and everything. It can deploy it for you. It's taking a lot of the complexity, even in an environmental situation, and making that much simpler. And so, yeah, I don't know, I've generally thought that programming has not been a good use of my time. Like, I remember when I was back in Magento, I made the mistake of being the main programmer for that, and it was a disaster because anytime you can do something, you're likely to do it. But I'm so tempted to dive back into this because if your speed and the quickness of execution can go up 4 or 5x, I don't know. Programming's fun and you could do some amazing things for your business.
I think you have a certain mindset that thinks programming is fun. I have it also. When it ceases to be programming though, and it begins to just be ideating and you see it to come to life on the screen, that is really, really powerful. When I tried it last, it was really good for creating things like, I think Zach was talking about, he built an inventory planner where, you just kind of put in your numbers and it does math and kind of gives you output and it's sort of self-contained. Where I started to struggle with it more was when I needed to integrate outside libraries, like when I needed to upload PDFs and store them in Amazon S3, when I needed to integrate the Stripe library to charge credit cards and make that work. When I started to need other libraries and other API calls that, to make the app talk with other parts of the internet, import things, et cetera, that gets more complicated. It needs more credentials. It's got to understand the exact API spec of the thing you're integrating with, which sometimes it does. But if it's 92% right, it still doesn't work. That was where I started to run into some of the friction. But again, that was 6 months ago.
Yeah. And I think that's gotten a lot better for people listening in, API or libraries. They're kind of the technical way that, I guess, Bill, you already mentioned this, probably repeating it, but that you can use your custom program to connect and speak intelligently with other tools so you can make integrations. And I have heard that one of the benefits of these tools is that they have a lot of context, especially for libraries, but increasingly for APIs, because that's the hard part. It's like, what's the right syntax for this? And if you can just say, hey, write me the API call to connect my app with Zapier or AWS, whatever it is, and you don't have to spend, you don't have to go, because the old way, Bill, I'm sure you remember this, like the old way was like, okay, go on the internet and dig through a bunch of knowledge docs and pore over them, or even go to an old book and go to, you know, pore through the index and try to find it. But if you get to the point where it's just ideation and everything else is fluid, it's a pretty powerful place to be.
I think we will find pretty shortly the gap is that people don't even know what's possible enough to prompt the AI to make it. You know, it's one thing to like know you have a problem. It's another thing to sort of be able to think your way through to a solution, what a solution might look like, and then ask for it, which I think that's what people have to get better and better at, or the AIs will have to get better at. Just describe your problem and I'll figure out how to solve it.
Yeah. One of the projects I want to do is we have e-commerce fuel is kind of built on a combination of a SaaS tool that runs our discussion software. It's Discourse, which I really love. It's fantastic. But then this kind of backend with the review directory and member profiles and things like that that we've all built. And I want to go through and import that project into one of these tools like Replit or Cursor and analyze it and see how difficult it is to overhaul an existing software project and have that the AI be able to understand the complexity of what you've already built. So hoping to do that in the future and we'll report back. But anyway, it's cool time. Excited to have that episode with Zach drop in the near future. Next thing that's up, two really notable things from the forums is we had a couple, we've partnered with Miracle Wanza, who's a longtime top forum contributor and very, very bright mind to create what we're calling ECF playbooks. So these are highly technical, very action-oriented guides. And she dropped a couple this week or this last month, the GA4, Google Analytics 4 playbook, as well as one on Meta Ads technical management. So if you're a forum member, you get those for free. We'll link up to those in the show notes. I actually used the GA4 playbook to dive into GA4 for the first time, which is embarrassing because I mean, I think the transition happened a year, 2 years ago, to finally wrap my head around it, understand the new parlance, the new architecture. And surprisingly, it wasn't as awful as expected. It's just crazy how when people switch things up on you, it takes a while to adjust. But it was a great guide for that. Thank you, Miracle. And Bill, I was going to ask you, are you using, when you think about analytics, like, are you using GA4? Are you using something like when you want to go check your analytics apart from the Shopify dashboard, what are you primarily using for that?
I haven't logged in GA in a while. I mean, we're doing a lot of IntelliGems right now. A lot of A/B testing through IntelliGems. We have been really focused, I mean, just lately on CAC to LTV analysis, cohort analysis inside of Lifetimely in Shopify, and then using IntelliGems to do A/B testing on landers. So we don't have very complex funnels in our business. You know, we don't have like deferred consideration over long periods or, you know, this whole, there is some education, but we're really focused on kind of, we're going to drive a lot of paid traffic through this funnel and see how it converts. So IntelliGems has been really awesome for that.
And disclaimer, I'm an investor in them. So just to make sure that's out there.
I am not, though.
You're not. Okay, yeah. wasn't trying to throw you under the bus there, but wanted to get out since I am. Have you been using them primarily? I know the product well, know the team well, and a super great team and cool journey, but I haven't used their product in the wild as much as you have. Are you using it primarily for A/B split testing?
A/B split testing on landers is how we're using it.
Okay. And why do you use it for that versus like Optimizely or, you know, some of the other tools out there?
I think because someone recommended it to me and it worked really well. It does a lot more, but, you know, I really like the way it presents the results. It does it, I'm sure Optimizely or whatever would be fine as well, but IntelliGems does a great job. You know, they run it until it hits stat sig. It shows me revenue per visitor, which is sort of our gold standard metric because that encapsulates conversion rate and average order value. So yeah, we've just liked it.
It's so interesting looking at GA, and I mean, GA was ubiquitous across every e-commerce store. That's just what they used. It was just a no-brainer. And then the transition to GA4, I think there's a meaningful number of people that once it transitioned over, they just abandoned it. Like they haven't logged in. They don't use it anymore. The way that they killed their place in the market as the de facto analytics tool is kind of surprising. So I don't know, maybe I'm rare there, maybe you're rare there, but it's pretty crazy.
I think they did it on purpose, clearly. I don't know why. Now keep in mind, right? They weren't getting paid for GA? I mean, I know there was like a GA plus that you could, you know, large organization could pay for, but as a percentage of Google's revenue, it was not meaningful. But when you think about it, the history of GA, where did Google Analytics come from? Why did it exist? It originally existed, you know, they bought Urchin, you know, way back when, and they bought it because they wanted to be able to show website owners that Google was driving them traffic and that the ad spend on Google was working, right? Was profitable. So they wanted to prove their value. And so they gave it away for free, right? To kind of get people spend money on ads on Google. I think now in 2025, you know, there are a whole bunch of different ways to measure that. The measurement inside of AdWords is significantly better. As I mentioned earlier in the show, there's a lot of other choices. I think they probably said, and again, I'm not privy to what's going on in Google, it probably was a little bit of a cost center. And I bet they viewed it as exposing some things that were proprietary to Google. And they, for some reason, they thought it was no longer strategic, you know, to be the way it was. And they changed it to GA4, which everybody hated because it was less functional. They took out all the keyword data, or a lot of the keyword data. Like, you used to be able to see what everybody was searching for and come to your site. They took it all out. So like, to me, clearly, everybody's framing this as an issue of incompetence. Google is not incompetent. Like, they did it for a reason. I don't know what that reason is, but it's not incompetence.
Slight devil's advocate flip side to that. Getting in there, and again, great playbook. I would strongly recommend going through that, the one that Miracle put together. I had the same thoughts, like, why did they butcher this? And you get in there and you spend a couple, 2-3 hours with it. And you realize a lot of the functionality is still there. It's just very different in different places. The way that you create reports is a totally different setup. So you can replicate a lot of the functionality. There's just a learning curve to it. And from a keyword perspective, yeah, you're right. I think they did neuter some of that. But I also know that even before that, for years, the amount of keyword specific data you could get, there's a lot of NA, like not available, that was coming through even prior to that. So it would be fascinating to get to buy a Google Analytics engineer, you know, a drink or three at the bar and try to figure out what was going on. Cause it's such a, just a weird way that they handled it.
You know, that's a good point too, though, Andrew, is that privacy on the web is way different now than it was, you know, when Google Analytics got started. There, a lot of it is just less useful. I mean, that direct traffic bucket that no one can explain just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? I mean, with all the Apple privacy stuff that's gone down, I mean, at some point, like, you deprecate the tool because it's not meaningful, you know, or parts of the tool because it's not meaningful. It's just a totally different world than it was when that tool launched.
So next one I want to talk about, this was one of the other top discussions that we had for the month. I'm going to keep this very high level for privacy reasons. We always, when we're talking about a lot of these topics, are going to keep them quasi-anonymous, if not fully anonymous. This one we'll keep fully anonymous out of respect for our forum members and just the privacy we have there. But kudos to this person for their honesty and their transparency. I think that's super important. And one of the things I love about some of the discussions in the forum. So this store owner came in and they kind of just laid it all on the table. They said, hey, we're making about low seven figures in revenue. We have 6 employees. I'm taking home about 100K in salary. And there's two big, you know, kind of three issues. And one of them was he was at a point where he didn't enjoy being the one, apart from the financial viability of the company, which was a little bit difficult. He didn't enjoy being the one who had to run the company or was the boss, dealt with meetings, had to deal with the bookkeeper, managing the team, being the person in charge. He didn't enjoy that. I think he was a bit surprised when like half of the forum jumped in there and were like, hey man, I'm right there with you. I joined the club. These are not things I enjoy. And so there's a number of things I want to talk about here, questions it prompts. But Bill, when you think about that question, like, do you enjoy being the boss? How would you answer that? I have some thoughts, but I want to hear your take first.
I think anybody that wouldn't answer that with depends on the day is lying, right? I mean, I love the leverage that comes from being in charge and directing a team to make my ideas and my strategies happen and then seeing if they work and then, you know, iterating. I love hiring people who are smarter than me, watching them cook, watching their achievements. I will say it got more and less fun as the company got bigger, right? It got more fun as the company got bigger because I could recruit higher level talent, right? And I more and more fun to have a great team around me. You know, when you're small, you can't afford a lot of talent and you sometimes can't afford the top tier talent. You end up with this sort of like, I have to be the lead dog type thing. And you're pulling everybody along our friend Brent Beshore would call that a hustler with help, you know, when you're smaller. But as you get bigger, you can start to bring on people who actually pull the cart with you, which is really awesome and makes it more fun. The flip side, of course, is as you get bigger, what I call the overhead of management increases, right? Meetings, reporting, alignment and consensus building, et cetera. And a lot of times the entrepreneur, the person who loves being an entrepreneur, who thrives in a fast pace, move fast and break things environment, as the business gets bigger, the overhead of management starts to crush them, right? They're spending more and more of their day in meetings and they go, I don't like doing this. I'd rather be working on things with the team. And I think the balance, the hope is as you scale, you're just going to have to do those things. Hopefully you hire people who are of high quality and need less oversight than people who are of low quality and would need more oversight. And similarly, also you're getting more done in the aggregate. Your organization gets more done in the aggregate, even if you, the leader, feel like you are quote unquote wasting more time on the overhead of management.
It's interesting that phrase or that label of a hustler with help. You talked a lot about, you know, you've spoken a lot about 4-hour work week and how you think that's kind of a pipe dream. And people who have listened for a while have known that I'm in the camp of having intentionally, you know, been in that category of the hustler with help, not wanting to scale the team between, you know, beyond more than 4 or 5 kind of in-house people intentionally, because I love the idea of working with and accomplishing great things, but I'm not sure I'm willing to make the trade-off of having that managerial overhead that comes with a, you know, significantly larger team. And I love tinkering. Like one of the things that I've been trying to do more on the sabbatical, I've talked about it, is get in the weeds. And I love that. Like the idea of sitting down, the idea of sitting down and doing programming with AI tools is about, you know, 10 times more interesting than thinking through how do you do, you know, kind of not strategic planning, but being in a meeting, for example. And I have a wonderful team. They're capable. They work autonomously. They're about as good as I could hope. But yeah, this for me, being the boss and the leader, it's one of those things, kind of like you mentioned, there are really enjoyable parts. But I think ultimately, the thing that I love the most about it is what it allows me to be able to create in the world and the outcome for it on the other side. So there's a lot of areas where I have to, like developing people, I'm not naturally a good developer of people. I have to intentionally work at that. And some people are amazing coaches. And amazing developers of people. And that's something I have to work at and kind of struggle through because it's not a natural talent of mine. So yeah, big, it depends, I think is the way I would say as well.
One of the lessons too that I took from that thread after reading it was the value of being open and honest with your peers. Because obviously, I forget who posted, I guess we're not saying who posted. The person that posted it was kind of felt as though he surely was the only person who felt this way. Right? That he was sort of stuck in his business, that he was feeling crushed by the management layer of it. And I think you even remember him saying, you know, I even feel bad for feeling this way. It must mean I'm a bad entrepreneur or whatever it is. And all of the replies are like, yeah, dude, me too. Like all day. You know? And I think he was really surprised by the level of support. So like the willingness, I mean, that's what I would say to any entrepreneur. And of course, it's the value of the e-commerce fuel community. It's the value of things like YPO and EO. You know, it's the value of being vulnerable and open with other entrepreneurs who are your peers. If you're willing to take that little leap and say, hey, maybe I don't have it all figured out. And of risk being embarrassed, I think what you'll find is either people also are like you and don't have it figured out, or if they do, they would be willing to help you figure it out. So the value of being vulnerable.
Oh yeah, people appreciate that, and they're much more likely to spend the time and invest the time to help you when you're being real with them.
Yeah. So if you're struggling in your business, find someone and tell them, I'm struggling in my business. I had a friend who came to me. It's a mutual friend of ours, Andrew, actually came to me and said, hey, I'm struggling in my business and I'm embarrassed about it. What do you think I should do? I ended up spending a whole day over at his facility going through all of his finance. I didn't charge him anything. Like we did it for fun. I did it for fun because we're friends and I wanted to help him, and he's clawing out of it now, you know, but if he hadn't come to me and risked being embarrassed and vulnerable in front of me, you know, I could have never helped him.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Andy from HelloBatch.com, where they sell super high-end CBD products and partner with a local farm out of Wisconsin. Really great, fun, friendly guy. Was hanging out with him recently at an awesome event. And here's what Andy had to say about his experience with E-commerce Fuel, our private vetted community for 7- and 8-figure store owners.
Hey guys, my name is Andy and I am the co-founder of Batch. Batch is a wellness brand that sells supplements. I started it about 5 years ago and I can confidently say that one of my biggest mistakes during our first 3.5 years was not joining ECF sooner. ECF has helped me solve so many important problems and challenges for our business. I wish that I had time to sit here and name all of them, but I only have time to name a few. Firstly, it has helped me expand and build upon our SEO and affiliate strategy in a really big way. It has helped us do this based on direct feedback and tactics from people in the forum who have done it before. Secondly, it has helped us now almost launch a series of products on Amazon. We have never launched on Amazon before, and we had considered using an agency, but based on the feedback from people in the forum who have done it before, they were so helpful and provided so much information and guidance that we feel confident enough to do this ourselves without an agency, which I think is really cool. Thirdly, it has helped us grow the manufacturing side of our business. I think another thing really cool about ECF is the breadth of experience you have within the community. As it turns out, there's a lot of brands who also do their own manufacturing. I've been able to connect with a lot of these community members and get tactics and strategies for growing the manufacturing side of our business. In summary, I just think ECF is so cool because it makes you feel less lonely as an e-commerce founder. There is someone in the community who has dealt with the kind of problem that you're dealing with before, and that person is always willing to help you.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8 figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Well, it's really hard too, I think, because if you're an entrepreneur so many times, your default answer is, I will figure this out. Because you kind of have to have that a bit, because if you don't, you're never going to get anything meaningful off the ground. You got to be a problem solver. And so you have to fight against that, because I'm the same way. I rarely, like, even in e-commerce fuel, I started the company and I am hesitant to go in there and post a question asking for help because I don't want to put people out, right? And it's just, I think it's just the ethos of, and it's not natural. It's not a healthy place, but it's the ethos and kind of the, yeah, it's just built into a lot of us, which we have to fight against. The next question, Bill, that thread prompted was, so this entrepreneur, after talking about this, he kind of said, hey, I want to find someone who can run the business for me. He kind of showed how he had hired a CFO to help and had waited for guidance from the CFO, but the CFO really didn't help him make any strategic guidance. He said that he was potentially hired a director of ops to help raise profits, but wasn't sure if that person was going to be able to do it any better than he could. And he was trying to think about, can I hire someone to take this over from me and solve the problems, more or less? The problems of A, not enjoying being the leader, and B, how do we get this company to a place where it's more profitable? And Bill, I'm curious on your thoughts here. What have you, that's the pipe, not, I shouldn't say the pipe dream. That is the dream from most entrepreneurs and owners, because I would say owners tend to skew 8, maybe 5 to 1, 6 to 1 visionary versus integrator, right? They're more big picture, their ideas, their vision, let's go get this, and less focus on the details, less focus on the how do we make that actually happen. And so the dream is you can find a great COO style person to come in and make all of your, you know, wildest dreams a reality and execute them. Easier said than done. So the question I want to pose is, what do you think you realistically can outsource in terms of those kind of things? Can you outsource, you know, vision? Can you outsource, you know, the actual execution of things? What should you keep for yourself as the owner, and what's realistic to have someone else competently be able to do in that role?
Like everybody, you know, everybody would love, oh, I'll just hire somebody to run my business for me and go to the beach, right? But I mean, you would be hard pressed to find very many people who've ever successfully executed that triple axel. Not to say it doesn't happen, right? But you're functionally trying, the incentives aren't right. Like you own the whole business. Right? You have all the upside. And also you're the personality that challenged all the status quos and is deeply ingrained in you. This is my problem. I'm going to figure it out. it's hard to hire that because they're already running their own business, typically. It's hard to hire the complete Michael Jordan, right? I find it's much easier to hire Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman and, you know, an incredible crew to surround yourself with so you don't have to pull the whole cart. The thing that is tough, though, is in a small business, it's hard to afford these people, you know, and that, I think, sort of the story of scaling a business is gradually, is scraping and clawing up the ability of your ability to hire good talent, and then gradually bringing better and better talent into the business as you can afford to pay for it. Because what you want to do is you want to bring in other people that maybe, if you can bring in an Amazon manager who is entrepreneurial, right? Maybe they're not so risk-taking that they go out there and start their own business, right? Maybe they're not an expert in accounting. Maybe they're not an expert in supply chain planning, right? But you can find somebody who you can really be, who can be entrepreneurial in part of your business, you know, and then you start to put those people around you. And before you know it, your team can do stuff without you, right? You've got there, you're not going to have a team of five Jordans, right? But you can be like, you want to move. I always use this analogy. Like, everybody starts a business and you start off as Jordan, your Jordan, right? Then you've got to find a way to stop being Jordan, to step off the floor, right? And become the coach, the Zen master, right? And so the players play the game, right? And you coach the team as the leader, right? And then only then can you go from the sideline to the owner's box. Because I think the CEO is the last one you can replace because you've got to have a fully functional team. Like, Jordan can't just jump to the owner's box because the team, without, like, you can't hire Michael Jordans, right? You've got to gradually move up the layers of abstraction. And so I think it's, if you're asking yourself, how do I hire a Michael Jordan to make all my problems go away? You should instead ask yourself, how do I upgrade all of my team members by 50% such that I don't need to hire Michael Jordan?
A slight rabbit trail, but Phil Jackson's an interesting guy. I don't know a lot about him, but you would imagine one of the top coaches of all time, maybe of all time, you know, won like five or six rings, went on and coached. I mean, he coached Jordan, he coached Bryant. Like, he, you would think he would be a hard driving, like, just taskmaster of a guy. And you learn about him, and he was super chill, mellow, like, into a lot of, like, you said Zen master. I think he was kind of a Zen guy.
That's his nickname, Zen master. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay. That's where you pulled that. But just not the type of persona that you would expect. And then Michael Jordan is exactly the type of persona you would expect, like, holding onto grudges for, like, you know, 30 years, fueling him. If no one has seen the series about the Bulls, I can't remember who did it, if it was Netflix or I think it was ESPN.
ESPN 30 for 30, I think. It was so good.
Last thing talked about, or actually in that kind of same vein with the thread about the business, I have had a handful of people, multiple people this last month, talk to me and come with a question around their business where it's in a situation where it's a declining business, either stagnant or revenues are going down. And it has a you know, at least one major existential issue that either they can't or they don't want to fix. They don't want to put the time in, or they don't know how to. So they're trying to decide, do you sell the business or do you let it kind of die a slow death? And the pros for selling the business, even if you only get a 2x multiple, it's probably the less financially wise decision. You're probably going to make less money, but you can have a clean tie. You sell it. You can move on with your life. From a headspace perspective, you're free. If you let it kind of just kind of wither away and die a slow death, you're probably going to make more than that 2x. You probably would almost certainly come out financially ahead. But then you have to deal with it for the next 2 or 3 years. And maybe even hardest, you've got to watch this thing that you've poured your time and effort into just kind of wither away and die, which is emotionally very difficult. So I was curious about your take on this, Bill. My thought has always been, unless it is a crazy amount of money, sell the business, have some closure, get the lump sum, move on with your life, have the bandwidth, have the mental clarity, and get on with things. But to me, that makes most sense in a lot of situations, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
I generally agree. I mean, I think the trouble, though, is if your business is really declining and is structurally in trouble, you'd be lucky to get 2x. You know, I mean, like, you could be talking about throw someone else the keys type situation, right? And that's often why it's, I think if it was as clear cut as you just described it, it would not be as hard a decision for folks. But a lot of times it's, you know, you're looking at 1x or something, because if a business has fallen 50%, 1x is 2x next year, you know, 2x is 4x. So like, you're just not going to get a huge number on a declining business, especially if it's a precipitous decline. That being said, I still think you should get your life back. You need to think about the opportunity cost of your time and think, is the highest return on my time fixing this business, right? Or starting a different business? And in 5 years, how will I feel about that? So I think it's always, what else would I be doing? And do I want to spend my one precious life pushing this boulder up a hill or a different boulder?
Yeah, it's a hard in the moment, but I generally agree with you. Markets, we are recording this February 27th. It may not come out for about a week. So you can get a sense, you know, we may be proven, you know, brilliant or absolutely idiotic in terms of predictions. But Bill, what are your thoughts on the markets right now, the public and or private markets? Like it's been, I did an episode last week, if you tuned in, about investing. And again, it was not investment advice, but one of the things I mentioned that was kind of counter to traditional investment advice I follow is don't buy any bonds. That's almost all stocks, because I feel like the risk to reward profile over time is much higher. And as if on cue, the stock market tanked to punish myself and anyone else who was listening. So the market's been down a lot this week. Tariffs, as of today, in a meaningful way for China, for Canada, for Mexico, are back on the table, which is unfortunate. Things have been weighing on the markets. It seems like we might be at a inflection point here. So anyway, Bill, I'd love to hear your thoughts, public, private sentiment, what you're seeing and thinking out there in terms of investment land.
I think you do have to separate the public markets, and the commentary on it is week to week is really a lot of noise. You know, even what you read in the papers, the metaphorical papers, right, is not always what's happening. I mean, you should see, you know, sometimes the market just moves for no reason, and then the newspapers have to come up with why it happened.
With story, yeah.
With story. So I don't know where the public markets are going. The tariffs are a big question mark. I mean, there's the political question marks are big, but they could go either way. I mean, like it could be a very exciting, you know, next couple of years, you know, with a more of a focus on free markets and less government intervention, especially if you're a US-based manufacturer. So I don't know where the public markets are going. I do know that they tend to go up and to the right about 8% compounded over the last 100 years or so. So I try not to buy individual stocks on shorter timelines than that. The private markets, though, have been interesting. I have noticed since November a material uptick in private markets. There have been some deals announced, especially in consumer, really big multiples that we haven't seen in a couple of years, revenue multiples, strategics are back in the mix. I mean, I've fielded a lot more calls, you know, late last year for our business. You know, once you get to a certain size, you just get calls all the time. I noticed that it increased materially kind of back half of last year. The private markets have ramped for sure in the last 3 months, which is great to see. And I think private markets take a longer term view, right? Private markets are influenced more by the availability of leverage, willingness of banks to lend. I've heard from a couple of private market participants that they're seeing banks bid on LBO deals to finance them with aggressive postures that have not been seen for 3 or 4 years, which is very positive for the acquisition market generally, for the availability of leverage. So I think things are looking the right way on the private side. Public, who knows what's going on?
Do you think, I mean, interest rates haven't changed that much in the last, you know, 3 months. Do you think that change in sentiment is just largely due to people looking at the new administration and perceiving it as more business friendly? Or what do you think is driving that renewed kind of fire in the private markets?
I do think it's that. It's animal spirits. And I mean, there's a lot of built up capital, right? There's like the private markets have been quiet for a couple of years. You know, I think people are ready to go and are feeling confident about the trajectory the country is on.
I heard one thing that was interesting, and I can't remember the source, but I heard a report that you've got all these, you know, private equity funds, people that are deploying money, and they were going out and trying to fundraise, asking new institutions, so maybe pension funds or maybe endowments at universities, saying, hey, we're raising another fund. Are you interested? And a lot of those larger institutions, the investors, said, well, we'd love to, but we haven't had any liquidity events from you in a really long time. So all of our money, we don't have any cash to invest. So if you make some sales and you know, we're able to get some money back, we can do that, which I thought was an interesting thought, and also kind of speaks to the state of the public markets, or the private markets rather, over the last handful of years.
Yeah, because they've been relatively frozen. A lot of capital went into the ground in like the 2020, 2021, and even a little bit, a couple of years pre-COVID vintage. And then markets slowed down, so everybody's just extending their hold period. So people like, yeah, you got paper gains, or maybe you don't if LPs don't feel they've been marking them correctly. So I understand the push from LPs for some liquidity.
Coming up this next month, if you're in our community, well, even if you're not, we got a big ECF rebrand, which we've been working on for 9 months, hopefully going live in early April, so a month-ish, which very excited to roll out and talk about in the future. There's an ECF official meetup in Atlanta on the 7th of March and one in LA on March 15th. Thank you, Kelsey, Matt, and Armin for opening your business to us in LA. And then ECF Carolina meetup. I think that's today. Bill, are you today, going to that?
I'm going there in 2 hours.
2 hours. Amazing. Tony, thank you for making that happen. Sturgeon, thank you for hosting. And also, I believe we got a Boston meetup going on today as well. So probably a little late if you're listening. But Manali, thank you for hosting that. So I know Tony a little bit better than I know Sturgeon, but both great folks. And Tony is one of the funniest people. The way he announced that meetup in the forums had me laughing and just rolling in my chair. He's an entertaining guy.
Tony is a very entertaining guy. Although now, this is how cynical I am now, I'm going to ask him when I see him if AI helped him write that. Anytime somebody, I mean, it's like now you can't trust it. Like people come up with these funny poems and songs. Like it's so easy to get AI to punch anything up.
It is, but generally when I try to get AI to write something funny, it falls flat. It's not very witty. It doesn't have, I would bet 5-1. My money is 5-1 on Tony for that, and open to taking bets on it because it was too good for AI. I don't think AI is, I've never seen AI copy that's that good.
I will ask him. I'll let you know.
All right. And Bill, I mentioned at the top, but the host of Acquisitions, or the co-host rather, of Acquisitions Anonymous. And you also do consulting for 7- and 8-figure store owners to help them optimize their financial stack, think about hiring, really as just a general purpose business elevator for their success and traction. So can you talk quickly about both of those before we wrap this one up?
Yeah, I'll take in the reverse order. And with the consulting, my job is really just to be sort of like a board member for hire. You know, like the idea is, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, it can be pretty lonely. And if you haven't raised outside capital, you don't have a board, you don't have people who have kind of done it before that you would want to get some advice from. Hey, learn my business. Tell me a little bit about what you would do or what not to do. So that's sort of what I try to provide. Folks can learn more about that on my website at BillDA.com. But Acquisitions Anonymous is more fun. So if you are interested in buying a business or selling a business or seeing how other e-commerce or other businesses run, what we do is twice a week, we publish an episode where we find a business for sale on a no names basis, aka the anonymous part of the name. And myself and my co-host break down how the business works, what the value drivers are, and how we would diligence this business if we were thinking about buying it. So we do a ton of e-com deals. You can go on the website and filter for just e-com deals, or there's all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, we've done a worm farm where they raise worms. We've done a pizza boat in the Bahamas that delivers pizza to yacht moorings. I mean, all kinds of crazy businesses too. So if you are a business nerd, if you're into business like we are, I think you'll like it. So it's called Acquisitions Anonymous, everywhere podcasts are downloaded.
Do you have a favorite business that you, over all the episodes you've done, where you're like, you know what, if someone's just like, hey, I'll pay for this one, and not on a size of earnings, but just on the quality and the durability of the business and the moat, what do you have a favorite that comes to mind?
There were a couple. I mean, there was one, everybody jokes that the pizza boat is my favorite because you get to live in the Bahamas. They had like their own little yacht that delivered it to all the other yachts. Like everybody was having a party. Like they're well known as the pizza boat. And the worm farm one was pretty interesting, but there was also one that made compliance software for municipal water utilities. So like every municipal water utility in the country has to issue like a certain report, you know, every year. And it just basically a bunch of, you know, audit number crunch and software. And they made software and like helped do the audit. So the utility didn't really have to think about it and can meet their compliance requirements. And that was a good business.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Government customer. I mean, everyone's got to have water. It's non-negotiable. Tap into AI to dramatically decrease your costs on coding. That sounds fantastic.
And they weren't even doing that. It was just they had these 25-year relationships with all these utilities that were legally mandated to use them. It was super sticky and like it wasn't a huge portion of the agency's cost structure. So why would they go bid it out? It was a really good business.
Oh, that's cool. It's a great show. Make sure to check it out and BillDA.com again for consulting. And Bill, if you know Bill, you know he's you know him well. If you know him, you know him. But if you don't, he is one of the rare people I know that has an incredible depth of experience across so many different of the disciplines in e-commerce, from finance, which he excels in, but also to acquisitions, to and selling and buying businesses, to leadership, to technology. One of probably the, if not the most well-rounded e-commerce entrepreneurs I know. So if you're looking for someone to consult that has a lot of competence across almost all areas of e-com, can't recommend him enough. So Bill, this has been fun. Always love doing this. Looking forward to the new and improved name next time for State of Play, which we will overhaul in the near future. So thank you as always. Always love it.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to being back.
If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.